You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hey, everybody. On this week's episode of Whiskey Neat, we talked craft spirits, transparency, and the craft associations that help kind of keep people honest and the stuff that we're trying to advocate for in the spirits world. And the perfect person to have that discussion with is Mark Schilling. Mark Schilling, head of Schilling Crafted, which started in 2017, is also responsible for helping establishing the Texas Distilled Spirits Association in 2012, as well as being the co-chair on the legislative committee for the American Craft Spirits Association. That's a mouthful, but we kind of talk the trends in the past and the things that have the problems that have come from it with craft spirits and the importance of transparency. And we really do kind of touch base on some of the controversies that are worth talking about. Devil's River is probably the most recent and the most infuriating. So we discuss really everything there is to know about those who lie, those who, whether it's out of ignorance or intention, and those who are honest on their labels. So very, very good discussion. I'm going to tell you now that although the discussion was great and I love the video portion of this, it's part of what I adore about this podcast. The video portion and the radio portion is only an hour long. We end up talking for an hour and 40 minutes. And the only place to find that full hour and 40 minutes is on iTunes, Google Play, and all your podcast platforms. We talk, and that 40 minutes that goes to iTunes is far more incendiary, far more unedited, far more controversial than anything that happens in the full hour. That's not to say that the first hour is not worth it, but go to iTunes, go to Google Play, and listen to the full hour and 40 minutes. I think you'll be, I think you'll find it interesting. So this week's episode is sponsored by Jack Daniel's as well as Glenmorangie, both big sponsors of the show. I'm a big fan of Glenmorangie overall. I love to see more scotch on the show because that's where I started with scotch. And of course, Jack Daniel's and our recent barrel pick that we did with Jack Daniel's Barrel Proof, big fan of the product. I also left in a couple shout outs to my friends over at Signatory, Matt Brown, shout out, and Whitmire's, a local Houston distillery, the first Houston area distillery since Prohibition, legal distillery since Prohibition. We're huge fans of this Texas craft producer, distiller, and I'm a huge fan of Signatory's cask strength barrel picks. So huge fans, big sponsors, lots of drinks. Lots of controversy this episode. You can find everything at mywhiskeyneed.com. It'll show you upcoming guests on the show. And subscribe on iTunes, rate, review, the whole nine yards. I appreciate it. Without further ado, it's just me and Mark Schilling this week, guys. Cheers. Thanks for coming. I appreciate you being here.
I'm glad to do it. I'm nervous as hell, but
why are you nervous?
I always get this way. It doesn't matter how many times I do something like this. It's always
and
that way.
You've done quite a bit of public speaking on the subject. Uh-huh. So, so tell me a little bit about Mark Schilling.
Well, that's the hardest part because I would much rather talk about the whiskey, the spirits, sure. the industry. But I guess it's important to have some sense of where I came from.
Right. I mean, well, most people's, and I've gotten this question quite a bit. You know, we live in a very small bubble.
Right.
Everyone who's in it knows who you are. But right. until they know who you are, everyone's first question is, who
right.
are you?
Where did this guy come from?
Yeah, yeah.
Why
Who's
is
this
he
guy?
Sitting here today?
Right. right.
And I wonder about that oftentimes.
And you're an advocate. You do quite a few things. We've talked about Wade, who was on last week's episode, mm-hmm. Which this one will actually air in a couple of weeks mm-hmm. from now. We kind of have stockpiled a couple. But we've talked about Wade's advocacy for transparency. Mm-hmm. And because there's a thing that happens in any kind of craft spirits, any kind of craft hobby, whether it's beer or whiskey, is there's a lot of snobbery and there's mm-hmm. a lot of quick reaction to write something off before mm-hmm. you even try it. And one thing that is probably the most divisive item, I would say, is sourced products. Mm-hmm. Now, for those who first find out about sourced products, they may get the wrong impression. Mm-hmm. And that impression is that when a distillery buys product from elsewhere and packages it at their distillery, that they're not really making it, so it can't be worth your time. And we know that's not true.
Right.
A big part of craft spirits is simply that when you start a distillery, a way to immediately build up the money necessary to distill really, really well. Because the other side of that is aged spirits. So mm-hmm. people want old products. Well, you right. can't just immediately start a distillery and not sell anything for 10 years. You've got to right. build up stock. And the way to do that is to source good product, mm-hmm. but some people source bad product, which right. kind of aids in that bad name mm-hmm. that source product gets. The thing that happens is people are quick to write it off. So it's a necessary part of any kind of distillery startup. You can make right. vodka, gin, source product. It's a quick money revenue situation. The trick is to get a good quality sourced one and then to be transparent about
right.
it.
Right. Transparency is key. And then also on the good quality sourcing, I think it happens less frequently, but you can get a good quality sourced product and fuck it up. And
oh, sure.
know, if you're not careful. But, you know, not everybody that gets into the business has the ability to do what Garrison did. His intent was to make bourbon and only bourbon and to do it grain to glass. And he was able to spend 2 or 3 years with no product and no revenue other than, I think he says, T-shirt sales, to wait on that product to be ready for market. It used to be that you could get into this business and you could produce vodka or gin or something else relatively quickly and get it in the market, but there's not very much space for that right now.
When you say produce, and this is there's going to be some what's the opposite of concentric circles? There's going to be some divergence
yeah.
with terminology. Typically, when a distillery produces a whiskey, what that really means is that they're sourcing it. But when you say produce gin and vodka, you mean actually distilling it,
right.
which is a really saturated market right now, specifically vodkas, which went through a boom in the early 2000s. And, you know, people literally exhausted that category mm-hmm. from every – I even saw a glazed donut vodka, right? So there that genre or that period was mm-hmm. vodka-centric, and now plus Tito's is king, right? So
right.
It doesn't make a lot of sense nowadays – to rely on your main source of income until you've aged product to only be vodka or gin.
Right. Well, so you mentioned produced by, and that's an interesting term because there's no definition for it. To me, produced is kind of like craft. It doesn't really mean anything, or it means everything. It doesn't legally mean
anything. It does trigger a response from someone.
Right. And so technically speaking, I know of at least a couple of labels out there that use produced by, and I know for a fact that they are doing everything in-house. I think that 10 years ago, it wouldn't have mattered as much, but you know, the consumer expects it to be distilled by, whether it's, you know, regardless of what you say on the label.
Do you mind? Are you able to say who's saying produce but is actually distilling to kind of cut them a break?
Sure, I can. And I haven't talked to them about this, but there is a relatively new distillery in Corpus, or right outside of Corpus, that's making rum. And I just picked up a bottle the other day, and it says produced by on the back. And I know for a fact that they're doing everything in-house. And after I saw that, on the front of the label in really tiny, hard-to-see lettering, it mentions, you know, distilled in-house. And so I think, you know, the smart thing for them to do is change that label.
Because they catch a bad rap.
Right.
Right. So, and there's actually been articles that have been put out there that said if it doesn't say distilled by, then it's sourced.
Right. Right?
They're pushing that agenda.
And it probably is.
For the 99% of the time, I would agree.
But if you don't know, you don't know. And there's right now, there's really no way to know for certain unless you visited the distillery.
Do you know the name of that distillery?
Let's come back to it.
Okay.
It's like right there. I can see the label. I want to say Wild Horse.
Okay.
Or something very, very similar.
Very similar.
That.
Yeah.
The other is actually Treaty Oak, which is interesting because, you know, I work very closely with them and we talk a lot about labels and transparency. And I noticed, you know, the bottle I brought here, the Red Handed, is sourced and it's very transparent.
Do you mind if we open?
Yeah, go ahead. But the
is it very transparent?
Yeah, I mean, it's called red-handed for a reason because they stole it. And it says on the side label there's a little bit of the story there that it's sourced.
And what
they're doing with it. But they have what's called the experimental collection, and it's a line of different whiskeys that they have done themselves. And the label is the same for all of them, so what they're using is a sticker – you know, to express for the different expressions and whatnot. And I noticed it says on the back, produced by. And I talked with Nate about it yesterday, and he's like, oh, shit, I didn't realize we were doing that. Everything – I thought, well, maybe there are some things in the experimental collection that are not distilled in-house, and they just didn't –
He just didn't realize.
No, it's like when they did that label, it was several years ago, and this was not a thing, and we didn't think about it.
And we've talked about Wade before as well in regards to what you just mentioned is an important thing that happens all the time. The Code of Federal Regulations, you know, has everything lined out as to how these things should be labeled and coded. And a lot of times the people designing the labels don't realize that saying produced by, or they don't realize that these – so it's a – I say the word ignorance, but not in a sense of insult, merely a state of not knowing.
Right.
And oftentimes just addressing them and letting them know, oftentimes they'll just correct it.
Right. I think there are two categories of producers, suppliers, in terms of the label thing. There's a category of folks who don't know certain bits and pieces. You know, it can get really complex and complicated when you're trying to figure out what applies to what. And especially if you've got somebody at the distillery that's handling labels that's not the person who knows the rules. Or if you're new and small, you may think you know the rules and you really don't. You know, the BAM, the Beverage Alcohol Manual, is really a guideline. You have to go to the CFR and really read through to get all the details on everything.
And for those who don't know, I mentioned the CFR, the Code of Federal Regulations, has all the legal jargon. And the TTB produces something called the BAM, the Beverage Alcohol Manual, every year that kind of puts it in layman's terms, what is required, what isn't required. And most people will use that instead of doing their due diligence and digging a little deeper. And, and even someone as well-versed as some of the people that we know locally, there's always some new topic that pops up that we didn't know or something that occurred. More recently, there was a discussion over distillering sourcing American whiskey, putting it in brand new barrels and then calling it bourbon because it originally was aged in used barrels. But by putting it in new barrels, we couldn't find anything in the regulations that would tell them you can't do that because it doesn't say it has to be exclusively aged in new oak.
Right.
So there's always something new to learn.
Yeah, I learn stuff constantly, you know, especially with labeling. You know, I'm always going back and rereading and you know, I'll second guess myself sometimes. I'll think, well, wait a minute, was it this or was it that? And I have to go back and review it. So, and, you know, it's tough to really understand all of that all the time if you're not super dedicated to the little details, you know.
So going back to who you are, you originally were a lobbyist, right?
Right.
In what capacity?
So I started out early on. I worked for the chemical industry, you know, a lot of which is situated down here. And, you know, over time, you know, I kind of moved around to different business-related organizations. And about, I guess it's little over 15 years ago, I left and went out on my own doing consulting, you know, client work. And so I've worked on all kinds of issues from energy to automotive to, you know, insurance, you know, almost all business related in some capacity over the years. But I was at a meeting with clients in Louisville, Kentucky a number of years ago. And guy at the meeting or our little reception the night before the meetings, who was from there, had brought some of his family's moonshine. And it was really, really well made. You know, typically when you get that kind of stuff, it's poorly made, poorly cut, overproof. You know, it's just made to be alcohol. And this was so extremely well made. This was, I want to say it was 07.
Drinking with a purpose. Right.
Absolutely.
Most of the times it's just to get drunk on.
Yeah. And this was stuff that they made for friends and family. They had never gone out and sold it. You know, several generations of refining the recipe and whatnot. So I'm coming back to Austin a few days later and I'm thinking, if he can make this stuff so well, why not get a permit and sell it? And then the next logical step was, if he can make this stuff so well, why don't I get a permit and sell it?
Right.
Yeah. So it was a period of time thinking about that until, you know, got to the place, well, yeah, let's do this.
And in 2012, you helped establish the Texas Distilled Spirits Association.
Right.
What is the Texas Distilled Spirits Association?
So that is an association of distillers in the state, formed for the purpose primarily of working for better laws and regulations for distillers.
And for those who don't know, the cost of distilling is usually very expensive. There's usually very high taxes involved. And really, at least in Texas, it's so much easier to open a brewery, for that brewery to fail, to go out of business before you even get a distillery up off the ground going. So you guys helped establish the TDSA.
So there's that. And then if you're going to do it right, it takes an even longer period of time. But you know, I think people don't realize often that in order to start up a distillery, you have to first make an investment before you even get permission from the government to operate.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, for your TTB permit, you have to have a still. You don't actually have to have possession of it, but you have to have a serial number, which means you've at least put down a deposit. In some cases, that could be a sizable outlay before they'll even consider your application. In Texas, your TABC permit is tied to your location. So you have to have a property, either a signed lease or a deed or something like that, that goes in with your application. And you can't do it in your house. So
before you're even allowed to begin producing product,
right,
you've got to commit to a location and a still.
Right.
Before
you've spent money you know if the government will let you be in the business. And then you have to develop a product. So you spend all this time and money to get your permit, then you get your equipment in place. You don't even have a product yet, or you shouldn't.
And even
you
then, you've got to wait a while.
Right.
Right. So most bourbons, although there's no age requirement for bourbon, most consumers are going to want you to at least have something that's, you know, at least a year old. I mean, there are some distillers in Texas producing months old bourbon, so you're talking a very long process.
Mm-hmm. So there's that. And then once you have a product, you can't sell it. You have no control over that. When we started TDSA, distilleries could not do any on-site sales at all. So now you can go to a Texas distillery and you can buy up to 2 750-milliliter size bottles every 30 days. Prior to TDSA, there were no on-site sales and you couldn't even give a free sample away.
So you guys are directly responsible for us to be able to go to places like Whitmire's and buy a distillery-only release.
Absolutely.
As well as drink on site.
Yeah. So there's before that, we couldn't sell anything at all unless we happened to have a wholesaler pick it up. So then you have to rely on them. They make or break your business every day, as does the retailer. And they don't sell your product. They distribute it. You still have to go out and make the sale. But guess what? I can't walk into a bar with my product and pour it for a beverage director unless my distributor rep is with me. Now, what sense does that make?
It's that enforced layer, three-tier system that kind of inhibits. It's strictly a way for people to put their hands in your pocket.
Yeah, And over the years, so many regulations have been promulgated that don't necessarily make sense for 2018, right? And if you think about it, you know, we've had beer and wine production in Texas for a long time. But until Tito, I guess, 96 or 98, there were no distilleries in Texas. So even TABC had no reason to understand what the regulations on distilling were.
They didn't get it. Right. So I know that when Travis, and we've got to take a quick break here, but I knew when Travis opened his distillery, same thing at Yellow Rose, the city of Houston didn't know how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And they no one knew the process of opening one or how to get it done. And there was a lot of questions that just no one knew the answer to. So I knew that Travis's whole endeavor, and I mentioned that too. Do you know Houston Ferris? I think they're also part of TSA.
Yeah, not well. I know Travis fairly well.
Yeah, so it's been one of those things that I know that craft beer has been the explosive scene for a while, but I hate to toot HBS's horn, but I think the whiskey scene in the state has exploded over the last few years. And distilleries, I know for sure there's at least two or three new distilleries opening in Houston now that, that are in the works. But do you know anything about that, Fox? Is it Fox?
No, I saw that, and that's the first I had heard of that. You know, I try to keep up with these, and for every one I know about, there are probably two or three others that not only do I not know about, I can't seem to find any information about.
Do you know about William Price Distilling as well?
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, it's a great name.
Wait, is that Brian?
Brian.
Yeah, I've talked to him. I wasn't sure. Yeah, I've talked with him about that.
And Brian, for those who aren't familiar, Brian is working on opening a distillery, William Price Distilling here in Houston, but he doesn't want to – when we had a lunch meeting one day, and we basically were discussing what his goals were, and he was wanting – nothing less than 2 years. Mm-hmm. Actually, he may have said 4 years. I think he said bonded. So 100 proof, 4 years old, and wanted it to be in the sub 50 range. So a big problem, as many might know, that with Texas whiskeys, they tend to be in the $50 plus range for a fairly young product. And it's one of the things that every distillery is working on improving and fixing. Mm-hmm. It's just such a costly process. And they're of course, they're still trying to age stuff.
Right.
So it's just a matter of time.
And that's a good sort of side topic to talk about. Why do these things cost so much? And some of the things that you may not think about when I say this, you're like, oh, well, of course. But everything for a small distillery costs more. You're buying glass in smaller quantities, so you're paying full price, and you know you're paying the full freight on something for maybe one or two pallets that you'd be paying for a truckload, plus a higher per bottle or per piece price. Your raw ingredients cost more. Everything you do costs more. You're probably using smaller capacity equipment, so you're not as efficient. I only know of one operating distillery in Texas right now that's using a column still. I know of a couple of others that are under construction or in planning, but I think almost everybody is doing pot distillation. Nothing wrong with that, but
still in column.
Still Austin.
Yeah, I was supposed to say Balcony's new stills are pots. Mm-hmm. They're big too.
But they're huge.
They're huge, yeah.
Yeah.
And I know they're now buying stuff by the truckload, which he had mentioned on the show. But so going back to Red Handed, I know that these guys are fairly young, right? And how long have they been around?
Actually, they are either the third or fourth distillery permit in the state.
Really?
Yeah.
So for some reason, maybe they're new to Houston?
I think they've been in the market. Probably you may know them more for the Waterloo Gin or the Treaty Oak Rum. Those were the first two products.
When I told you I had met with Joe at one of the Texas festivals, so I consult with other festivals as well because I think the state should have good events here, and you know, helping these events kind of realize that some priorities of theirs aren't really synced with the producers. Mm-hmm. They're super costly. They use licensed venues only. So a couple events, a couple years back, I consulted with the Texas Monthly event, the first one, which was 2 years ago. And I told him, you got to use a non-licensed venue.
Right.
It's so much cheaper. These distilleries don't have these huge marketing budgets. And I met Joe from Treaty Oak there. And using a non-licensed venue allows you to bring in experiments, stuff that right. hasn't been released yet. And so going to these events, you want to appeal to you want to entice the nerd, right. someone who is impassioned by what you're doing. Right. So when we first came out with our event, we went to the guy's name is Doug Burgess. He's the local compliance office here in Houston. We had ran they wanted every mm-hmm. freaking detail. And we got approval we had no issue mm-hmm. with them being there. Just certain levels can't.
That's been one of the challenges with TABC over the years. There's a lot of inconsistency.
And getting them all caught up.
Yeah. Some of it has to do with training. Some of it has to do with folks who have been around for a long time automatically putting spirits in the same box as beer and wine. And the rules, although a lot of times they're similar, they're not always the same.
Sure.
Same thing with TTB. There's been explosive growth.
Explosive growth.
Yeah.
I went and looked at every label approval that was submitted since January for specifically bourbon, and it was north of 700. Mm-hmm. And these guys are just...
Well, and if you think about it, when we first started Revolution, label wait times were, I think, about 55 days. And now you can get a label turned around in most cases within a couple of days. They've added staff, they've added resources. But if you think about not just for spirits, but think of the beer labels, especially with all of the seasonal and one-offs and things
the
like that.
The formula approvals and
stuff. They're taking so much time of TTB's time to process all of that
and
stuff.
And wine as well.
Right. And when we talk about some of the inconsistencies you see with label approvals, a lot of that is just because of the sheer volume that they're trying to get through.
So you mentioned Revolution Spirits. Let's back up here. So TDSA was started in 2012. Revolution Spirits was started in 2013.
Yeah, funny story about that. We'd been working on Revolution for a while. And at the same time, you know, with the background as a lobbyist and working with business organizations and things like that, it was clear the need to have an organization for distillers in order to promote our place at the Capitol. So in working with that, you know, we got a number of distillers together, several meetings worth, and finally kind of everyone was hesitant at first. We finally kind of got over that initial challenge, and everybody came together and put the association together. And then they told us we couldn't join because we didn't have our permit yet. So it was probably another 6 or 8 months after the formation of TDSA that I really pushed before I could join, because I was still waiting on
you
my
helped
permit.
Start it, and
yeah,
you couldn't join it mm-hmm. until so yeah. And then the Wine and Food Foundation, that was also 2013 to 2015. But well, I'm sorry, let's back up. Revolution Spirits, what you guys, so you guys were producing your own products?
Yes and no. Our principal product was gin, and still is, and that's redistilled. You know, we purchase neutral, and then we redistill off of that, which is pretty common with gin. It would not make sense as a small startup for us to produce our own base spirit. It would cost us so much that our shelf price would have to be $60 or $70. You could get that for a good bourbon. You can't get that for a gin.
Right.
But it's very traditional in gin making. In fact, it used to be until relatively recently, I want to say maybe the early 80s, but I'm not sure. It used to be required for UK gin distillers to purchase their neutral from one of several approved sources because they considered the craft in gin to be what you do with the botanicals that you're using. So one of the things that is really interesting when we talk about craft, and that's a sort of a whole other category of conversation and a term that I don't really like, there's always discussion about creating certifications and guidelines and things like that about what is craft. And I think if you do that, you have to be careful to treat different spirits and different categories differently, sort of based on their history and tradition.
Well, I agree with that completely, because part of the complaint I've had with bourbon, or not bourbon, beer, mm-hmm. is part of the guidelines for determining craft beer has to do with how much you produce. And I think that's mm-hmm. absurd.
Right.
I think the craft should be about the craft, right?
Right?
So if you had a, woodworking is a craft.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think the definition of craft should be about the process, not about the quantity. Mm-hmm. So if you're producing a ton, but it's all quality work, regardless of how much spirits, right. I think it should be based off the process. Where beer, I think it's something like 60 or 80,000 barrels, mm-hmm. then you're no longer considered craft beer. I don't think that's fair.
Right. I mean, look at the legacy producers and the distillers behind those brands. I mean, you can't tell me that those guys are not craftsmen, because they are in every way, shape, and form. And so it's really unfair, I think, to try and take that term away from them.
I agree completely. So I'm pretty much – I'm going to get the rest of this here. Tell me about Uncle Billy's.
So Uncle Billy's is a brewery in Austin that has recently gotten a distillery permit. I'm working with them. You know,
they were a brew pub, weren't they?
They were originally a brew pub and They wanted to expand their distribution and so became a brewery, which meant they lost all of the other benefits of being a brew pub. So, the thinking was, well, let's – and this is – becoming relatively common, popular for breweries to add distilleries and distilleries to add breweries and things like that. So that was the intent. And along the way, they found that because of the location where they were, the city of Austin would not let them do distillation on site. So suddenly they have a real challenge. They're halfway through the process, can't distill on site. Well, what are we going to do? I think the goal eventually is to build a distillery elsewhere. But then I came on to help them sort of work through and decide how to approach all that. We've got a couple of source products. This is one of the first ones. It's bourbon. It's 100% MGP. The only thing we've done to it is proofed it down. You'll see on the label, it says, as it should, distilled in Indiana, and it's not on the back, it's not in small letters,
it's on the front.
It's front and center. And you know, anybody that I work with, we're going to talk about transparency and honesty and ethics. And if you're going to source something and if you're going to work with me, it's going to be really apparent that you're sourcing, what you're sourcing, why you're sourcing.
Right. So, and again, to reiterate, it's not the idea that you're sourcing, it's the idea that you're lying about it.
Right.
So typically or historically on a lot of products, and I'm going to throw Templeton on the bus again, mm-hmm. as we did last week. Templeton had been touted as being Al Capone's original recipe, just complete nonsense. And they were sourcing the product from MGP, Indiana. So the TTB now has a guideline that if you source a product from out of state, not if it's in state. So mm-hmm. if it's in state, then you don't have to list the state of distillation. That's where the key words produced and distilled by will give you the key from there. But in this particular case, you guys put it on the front label, mm-hmm. let it know right off the bat that this is blended and bottled at Uncle Billy's in Austin. It's aged 18 months and it's distilled in Indiana.
Right.
No complaints.
Yeah.
At that point, it just becomes about the spirit itself.
Yeah. It's exactly the same thing that you're going to get from anybody else that's sourcing the high rye from MGP. The only difference is the way it's cut.
And what does this normally run?
It's only available on site right now. I think if it goes into distribution, and going back to the issue of all the products on the shelf, people are not looking for another bourbon or another rye. They're looking for things that are unique,
right.
that have a certain character and creativity. So, you know, I don't know that this will ever be distributed. It might, and if it is, it'll probably be small. This is just something to kind of help work along the process of what eventually will happen.
A full distillery.
Yeah, and before then, I think the next step will be mash and fermentation using the brewery on site, creating the mash bill, you know, choosing, you know, how we're going to do the fermentation, and then working with somebody else to distill off site, and then come back, bring stuff back, and barrel for aging. So. There are a number of steps along the way. What I love about the Uncle Billy's project is because of the constraints that we have, it forces us to be extra creative and thoughtful about how we're going to get from A to B and then eventually to Z.
So, and I had mentioned the Wine and Food Foundation. So explain to me how that worked.
So a lot of people in the spirits business come from a beer background. I don't. I come from a wine background, not from production, but from just a real interest. And so, you know, I got involved in sort of the local, kind of like HBS, sort of the local wine scene in Austin. And over a number of years, got involved in the foundation. And, you know, what happens if you show up to meetings? Eventually somebody asks you to serve on the board. And then if you serve on the board, eventually somebody asks you to run for president. And I ended up there. And I, you know, I used to tell people that I got into the spirits business to pay for my wine habit, until I realized not too long ago that that's not been working out very well. And thankfully, I've got a pretty decent stash of wine at home to get me through until I can start buying again. But so that was kind of that gave me a really great starting place when I began looking into building a distillery and getting into the business, because I knew a lot of people, whether they were in the wine business or in distribution or retail. So I had a lot of people to go to that I could ask questions to about the industry as a whole. And that was really helpful.
So, and you did that from 2013 to 2015. And now you currently serve as the co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the American Craft Spirits Association.
Right. So I've been doing that for a number of years. And to go back sort of to the very beginning, as we were looking at starting up Revolution, there was an effort underway in the industry to lower the federal excise tax on spirits.
Didn't that just pass?
It did. End of last year, it was passed for a two-year period. So we have to go back and work to have it reauthorized or made permanent. So it's an ongoing effort.
I'm sure it'll get...
I hope so. I mean, typically when you get something into that two-year cycle, you know, they go back at the end of every Congress, and very rarely do they not reauthorize things. But, you know, you never know going forward what's going to happen.
So what did it go from to now what it is?
It went from $13.50 per proof gallon to $2.70 per proof gallon. That's approximately an 80% reduction.
That's awesome.
It applies to every proof gallon removed up to 100,000, and it applies to everybody, even the big guys, because it's about, you know, fairness and parity.
Right.
But sometimes we get asked, well, why 270? What's that based on? And that's a really good question. The guy Melkin Kosrovian and Ralph Lorenzo, who I consider sort of the godfathers of this effort, it was based roughly on the discount that small beer producers have compared to the large producers. You can't compare apples to apples because of the way that the taxes are figured and the volumes are figured. So it's based
loosely
on that.
The laws are different as well. Yeah.
And it's been a huge benefit to distillers. You saw Travis is buying some new stills.
His stills are gorgeous. They're already in.
Are they in?
Yeah, okay. They're absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
You know, in the Scotch world, they make a big deal about your stills and what it means and how your spirit. In the Scotch world, they're big about terroir, right? So where you distill your product, the actual still, every little dent in the copper pot still, you know, because with Scotch, you have to distill from a pot still. You can't use column stills. And just you know, they're big as to, you know, the water source, where it comes from. So the first thing I thought, because I'm a huge Whitmire supporter, is this going to change the spirit? Are we going to, because I'm
sure it will.
I hope for the better, because, and I mean this with all the love in the world, I think they are the best Texas product being distilled right now. I think everything doesn't have to taste like Kentucky bourbon.
Right.
But,
and it shouldn't.
Correct. Correct. But when it comes to, and I'm going to open this now.
Thank goodness.
When it comes to Texas distilled products, it's not so much that it's different from Kentucky, but that it's so different, that it's so completely off of what people are used to. I mean, it might as well taste like a different spirit if I can get this open. And Travis, I think, is the closest thing while still being fairly different and young. I mean, this is 2 years old on the dot. So this is, I mean, really, it's straight bourbon. Uncut, unfiltered, barrel proof at 108 proof. And this is a distillery-only product. So this is not on the shelf.
And so I have this bottle at home. And
do that again there.
I want to remember, I'm trying to think, it was probably last fall, I guess I picked it up. And as soon as I got home, I had tried it at the distillery, but as soon as I got home, I tried it again. And I sent Travis a message and I said, you know,
it's incredible.
This is the best Texas-made bourbon I've had to date. And
I mean, the color on it, the viscosity, it's extremely oily. And you're familiar with the Liquor Hound?
I'm not.
So there's a guy on YouTube known as the Liquor Hound, Chris Trevino. Very nice guy. He's sitting on a mountain of whiskeys, and he reviews stuff and talks about stuff. So we sent him a bottle of I think it was the Christmas barrel, the 218 or something, or 221. And he doesn't review stuff unless he likes it.
Mm-hmm.
He'll give constructive feedback, but his opinion, he goes, I completely agree. I think when it comes to Texas produced spirits, I don't know what Travis is doing. I don't know how he's doing it, but something about this is the closest thing. It's just the best, in my opinion, the best bourbon being produced in Texas. Yeah.
I think right now,
and I like a lot of them.
Yeah, Travis and the Licorice Brothers.
Oh, I love the Licorice Brothers.
Those are my two favorites.
Iron Root Republic, for those who aren't familiar. I'm a big fan of theirs, and I'm a big fan of their Starka. So
I haven't had it yet.
So that was their gin base, mm-hmm. and they had popped it into a barrel, and then we're doing something, and they kind of stumbled. You know, with some whiskeys, you hear stories about on the label where it says, oh, we stumbled upon this hidden barrel mm-hmm. or this hidden recipe, and it's mostly bullcrap.
Right.
But with them, they were tasting through to see if it was ready, and they were like, this is good on its own.
Mm-hmm.
So I know they've done a couple of private barrels of it. But their Starka is, I think, one of their best products, yeah. and it's not even technically whiskey.
Right. Well, I tasted some of the gin early on while they were still kind of working through, but I've not seen that.
Man, that's just – it's so dark. It tastes so intense.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's using 30-gallon barrels, is that right?
So he's using 30-gallon barrels. Forgive me. High-proof whiskeys make my nose run, but he's using 30-gallon barrels. Now, I know that Travis is sourcing whiskey from out of state, but there's a little...
That's the blue label?
The blue label. Yeah. So there's a little... I still haven't come up with a name for this. The opposite of red flags. Little green lights, little keywords that mm-hmm. kind of... If you're going to look at a source product, mm-hmm. His source product is cask strength.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And typically when you source a product, a lot of them will cut it and blend it, which, again, there's no mm-hmm. no issue with that. But he produces a $60 bottle that is sourced, and it's cask strength, and it's great. And he sources it from Kentucky. Mm-hmm. So there's no and it's not too far different from his own spirit. Right. So I'm a big fan for Whitmire's. I think they're doing good stuff. And they're good. They're good guys.
Yeah, and you know, I'm glad they've got the new equipment coming in, because I'd like to see more stuff around in more places.
How long are you in town?
This afternoon.
I'd swing by on your way out.
I kind of have it on my list, depending on. I've got a couple of other things to do, and you know, I try to get by there when I'm in town. And
their stills.
And he owes me an email, so I'm going to give him some shit about that.
Yeah.
If you're listening, Travis.
So he was supposed to be here today. I invited him to come talk, because I do want to talk about controversy in specifically with Texas spirits.
So I have a thought about that, and this is my opinion. I've mentioned it to a couple of other folks in the industry, so it's not something that is a thing yet. But you know, there are a lot of different ways to address this, and I don't think there's any one way that takes care of it fully.
Okay.
There's always going to be some issues, but I'm kind of leaning right now towards talking with the TTB about requiring state of distillation on everything whiskey, regardless of where it's from or what, you know, if it's a blended or a spirit whiskey or whatever it is. Just require the state of distillation on everything.
So regardless of, even if it's sourced in state.
Right.
So what purpose would that serve? So anytime someone comes up with an idea of like, this is what I want to improve, what are you improving by requiring someone who sources something within a state to...
Well, that's a challenge. And like I said, it doesn't take care of everything. I think there are some other things that we have
to do. But it solves a problem with places like Devil's River, who is being accused of sourcing out of state.
Right. And let's talk about them for a minute, because I talked with Mike a little bit yesterday, and I mentioned to you
Mike?
Before. Mike Cameron is the owner and founder of Devil's River.
Okay.
He's also the president of TDSA. Super great guy. He has done a lot for the industry. Time, effort, money. A lot of the things that you're enjoying as a consumer, being able to buy a bottle at Whitmire's, it's because of his involvement. And I think that, like I said earlier, there are two different sets of folks that we have some challenges with labels. There's some folks who are not necessarily trying to flagrantly violate the letter and spirit of the law and
from
present
a place
something.
Of ignorance,
right?
Right, not knowing any better how
right?
it's coming
or
across.
Or maybe there's some little details that have been overlooked or something like that. I know from talking to him, I think his problem is more a matter of when that first label approval came out.
So let me back up for a second. Yeah. So for those who don't know the situation, Devil's River is a fairly new bourbon out of Texas. Its entire story is centered around being cut from water with the Devil's River, which was the Rio Grande or
I think it's a tributary or something.
Right. Okay. So it's one of those brands that is very based on the story of how the water is cut where the water comes from, which is Texas. And they caught some flack a little while back because their label approval originally had said distilled in Kentucky, produced in Texas. When the final product came out, the state of distillation had been removed. So as it turns out, and I'm getting there, so the controversy ensued, right? People are pissed off because they are making it seem as though the product is a Texas product, that it's from Texas using Texas water, when in fact it had been distilled out of state. Come to find out, so let me back up a little further. When it got out in the group, a bunch of people contacted Devil's River's Facebook page. To which, and this is, before I continue, I think Devil's River faced a little bit of a bad rap unfairly, but also there were some things that they did, whether it be him or his.
I think they did not manage it well.
Correct, which is my opinion. Right. I think they could have done things a little differently to prevent the firestorm that ensued, which I almost didn't say firestorm. So essentially when a few people from the group contacted their Facebook page, these people were subsequently blocked.
Mm-hmm.
And when you, which some would call a bad response, and when you have a bad response, it might... And it might invoke an alternate bad response. So, of course, that's what happened. People lit their page up with bad reviews. A whole thing happened. It got to the distributor, RNDC, who was really upset. And it got over to, of course, the people who matter over at Devil's River. So, that being said, it come to find out, someone had accidentally... There were several label approvals for Devil's River. The first one had that stated distillation, which apparently should have never been released.
So what happened, I believe, and I hope that I don't mess this up, and I've talked to him about this a couple of different times. Originally, it was going to be sourced from Kentucky until he found an opportunity to distill in Texas. So right now it's being distilled in Texas. He's never sourced from Kentucky. So my understanding is that initial label approval was kind of got out before everything was sorted out. But it's being distilled in Dallas. I'm not sure at which place. There are a couple of places up there that do I guess contract distilling.
Okay.
He is building his own place in or near San Antonio. It's all Texas grain, Texas grown. It is technically a Texas grain to glass bourbon.
Okay.
I think, based on what I know, what I've heard from him, what I've seen, kind of followed along, I think the only thing missing on it right now is it's 2 years old. Everything he has is 2 years old, and it needs an age statement.
Correct.
I'm not sure why that's not there, and I did not have a chance to ask him about that.
So I know why it's not there. And that comes from a place of not knowing any better. So there were a few people, a few other distributors, and someone who will be on the show next week, Nico Martini, mm-hmm. who actually reached out to their legal team.
Right.
And gave them the list of three or four things that were wrong with the label. It was missing state of distillation. If it was distilled out of state, then you're technically not supposed to make the label come across as a Texas product if it's not. And so meaning if it was from New York and all over it was like Alamo and Lone Star State and this is that, that's technically not supposed to
mislead. And there are others out there that are much more flagrant violators.
Sure, in every way. Even some locally. Yeah. But then additionally, there's also an age statement required for any whiskey under 4 years old. Mm-hmm. And when those were sent up their legal chain, and I've got the guy's email, I forget his name, he had responded to Nico basically saying that that's for straight bourbon, which is not true. If any whiskey under four is supposed to require...
So it's typically a mistake that they made
in-house when they submitted that. When it was brought to their attention, he rejected it mm-hmm. instead of revisiting. So... They got kind of a bad rap, and it's not Mark is his name. It's
Mike.
Not Mike. It's not Mike's fault that whoever was managing the Facebook page, you know, blocked people or responded bad. But I actually tried to reach out to them via their website and said, you know, who I was. I run a local group, and this is where this firestorm happened. If you guys want to give me an official statement that we can just kill this right in the bud. And I didn't get a response. And then I also sent an email to that legal guy, no response. So just I think, in my opinion, that when something's happening, a statement should happen. In fact, we were actually told by someone, I'm trying to remember who it was, that they were in the process of releasing a statement. And that, so I told the group to leave it alone until we got an official statement, to which we never received. So.
I don't know anything more about that, but I'm going to make a guess. I'm going to guess that they were in the process of doing that, and somebody with an ATTY behind their name, for whatever reason, said don't do it.
Yeah.
And I think maybe had a good legal reason for saying that, but as far as PR goes, probably a bad idea.
So and we actually – there were a few people who had reached out to me and said, you know, unless you want to be listed on this cease and desist or whatever, you should put a stop to this. So – I got a little nervous, not because I'm worried about – I'm not scared, but I also have a lot on my plate with social and, of course, trying to put – at the time I was putting together this show, I didn't feel like dealing with it.
I think it's a combination of misunderstanding on everybody's part, missteps on their part. And as you know, once something gets out there, it sort of grows, especially if it's left unchecked. But I think even at this point, whether it's them or anybody else that – finds themselves in a similar situation, once it's out there like that, it's really hard to come back and fix it.
So. Well, and what had gotten out at one point was that this was just before Christmas. We found out a few RNDC reps that their Christmas bonuses were tied to pushing this product, meaning they had – and then we also heard from some local liquor stores that had said – and this is not Devil's River's fault.
Right. Well, and then it's also when you hear things, you never know what you're hearing or where it's coming from or why.
And I know for sure what I'm about to say, I know for sure as fact because I talked to the distributor about it. But the distributor, and they're not supposed to do this, but local reps whose bonuses for Christmas were tied to this product were also kind of twisting the arm of local mom and pop stores for allocated items in order to get those. So for instance, hey, if you want your Blanton's allocation, then you need to bring in two cases of this Devil's River. So there was this, which is not Devil's River's fault at all.
No, legally, you know, a producer can provide a wholesaler with a financial incentive, but there can't be any strings attached to it. It has to go to the wholesaler, and then the wholesaler decides how to manage it.
How to implement that,
So there can't be any sort of connection between the two.
And I know that RNDC's official policy is don't do that, right? So whoever these reps were or whoever was doing this shouldn't have been doing it. But with all of the miscommunication, the consumers were upset, the local mom and pop stores were upset, and we had no one to talk to. So just a simple, like today, you've sat here and you've been very open about everything, then there's no question, you know. Right. So there's this natural human behavior to assume the worst until you know right. the details, right? So, but and I forgot how we got on the subject of Devil's River, but
State of Distillation, I think.
Yeah. So officially, and that was another thing is their Facebook page. They did respond to one person who, of course, they screenshotted that and it shared it. In their Facebook message, their canned statement was that they bring the spirit to Texas. Mm-hmm. So, which of course lets us know that it should have a state of distillation on it.
Well, I think that could be just a matter of semantics. You know, if you think about, you know, I could say I've got a distillery in Austin and I make this thing and I'm bringing this to Texas. Not necessarily that I'm bringing it physically from somewhere else, but I'm creating and bringing something to Texas that came from here or,
sure.
or elsewhere.
So, yeah.
You know, maybe it was a poor choice of words.
Sure.
You know, I don't want to second guess that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, but you're providing
you have to think a little bit more broadly about where this stuff comes from. And, you know, and I don't know what the case is for them, but I know that there are a number of distilleries who have people managing their marketing, their social media, their advertising that don't necessarily have a background in spirits or alcohol, beverage alcohol particularly. So they may not think about the same usage of words and things in the way that it might come across to consumers for this market as it might in a different kind of market.
I agree completely. I know that even places like Jack Daniel's, the never-ending debate of whether or not it's bourbon is all because of their marketing team.
Right.
So the if you Google – and it's crazy how things populate in Google. If you Google, is Jack Daniel's bourbon, the Google answer that comes back pulls directly from that section mm-hmm. of the marketing side of their website.
Right.
And there's been this – never-ending battle, right. You know, almost Middle East style, where there's never going to be an end to it.
The real answer is, does it really fucking matter?
Correct. Yeah.
If you like it, drink it. If you don't like it, don't drink it. You know, my personal opinion. Yeah, it's bourbon that has this added thing that they do that they talk about. There are probably bourbon producers in Kentucky and elsewhere that are doing something just like that or similar to that. They
a lot
just
of
don't
them
talk
do
about
it.
It.
Yeah.
And then the. As you mentioned earlier, you know, the regulations don't really specify the things that you can't do. They just say that bourbon has to meet this minimum standard.
Sure.
I think it's a really interesting question.
So they don't – and I know the answer to this. They don't – the regulations do not address filtering. And the assumption is that because they're using sugar maple, that it adds flavor to it because everyone picks up on the notes of bananas and Jack Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
But officially, filtration is a subtractive process, not an additive process. So if
officially, I could argue
sure.
somewhat that point.
But until that's been ultimately
right.
established, the official guideline is that because there's lots of Kentucky bourbons
yeah.
that are charcoal filtered.
Well, think about it. If you're filtering your whatever it is before it becomes Jack Daniel's, whatever, if you're using a charred maple cask rather than oak, isn't that kind of the same thing?
So, agreed. Yeah,
kind of.
Because that argument is made all the time. The process of aging bourbon includes its interaction due to cold and hot weather being absorbed into the barrel's wood and then being extracted out
right.
over and over for years and years.
Right.
It's being constantly charcoal filtered.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Wade makes that point a lot. All whiskey's charcoal filtered,
yeah.
but...
Bottom line, it doesn't matter if it's bourbon or not.
Well, I think that the only reason why it's a constant discussion is because the snobbery
right.
that stems from that misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. So if you go to a bar or restaurant that has bourbon listed and Jack's under it, you get that jerk that's like, hey, excuse me, ma'am,
yeah.
why do you guys have this listed here? Or if you say your favorite bourbon and you say it's Jack and then people chew you up.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So the issue there is not that – is it or isn't it? Because a rose by any other name
mm-hmm.
is still, you know, smell just as sweet. The issue is the insult or shame that comes with one or the other,
yeah.
you know?
You know, I had a friend of mine did a blog post a few years ago about what bourbon would you choose for a mint julep? And I was one of the folks that he talked to. I said, you know what I would use? I know it's sacrilege. I'd use Jack Daniel's. You know why? I don't particularly love mint juleps. I don't particularly love sweet sort of cocktails. And if I'm going to use a bourbon or a whiskey in a cocktail, I'm going to use something that I probably wouldn't sit around and drink neat. And it just seems to me that is a good combination. And, you know, a lot of people are aghast at that. Like,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. Is it all stems from the amount of shaming that's involved. Mm-hmm. And I'm a huge, huge fan of Jack Daniel's single barrel and an even bigger fan of their single barrel barrel proof. Mm-hmm. That's why we bought a whole barrel. Yeah. And when we were up there, we brought it up to their assistant master distiller, and he said, yeah, it's bourbon. We just choose not to call it bourbon. And that's the key is you – all the stuff that's required for your label, for instance, you mentioned it perfectly. Putting the words distilled by lets the consumer know, but you don't have to put the words distilled by. You could put the words produced by.
And you know, I think it would be helpful if TTB defined all of the things – produced, distilled, made, blended, whatever it is. I think it might be helpful if they defined and clarified all those things so that when you put that on your bottle, everybody knows exactly what you're talking about.
Same thing with the whole Jack debate. If Tennessee whiskey, which is defined by state law as well as NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, as being a straight bourbon whiskey aged in Tennessee and then gone through the Lincoln County process, if the TTB established that category – that potentially could solve the problem.
That would be a game changer, and you know, sort of an extension of that. In Kentucky bourbon is legally required to be aged in Kentucky for a year. That's completely contrary to the TTB standards, right? So
which
if you think about
there's
that,
no age requirement.
There's no age requirement. So if you are a distiller in Kentucky and you want to produce an 11-month bourbon and call it Kentucky bourbon, what happens with that? I don't know the answer, but I feel like, you know, and I don't know that anybody
call it bourbon,
is or
you just
or would
call
be.
It Kentucky straight bourbon or Kentucky bourbon.
According to TTB, I think you could, though.
Well, the TTB doesn't define the state requirements. States do, right? So, for instance...
I guess that's right.
Right, so they could call it a bourbon. Mm-hmm. They couldn't call it a Kentucky bourbon. Which that's where the state
but they could call it a bourbon made in Kentucky, which is exactly the same thing.
Sure.
And so just like with all the other labels, there's so many little loopholes and ways you can get around things that I think we need to figure out how to address. The best way to do it is just for consumers, I think, to really push for and require producers to be completely transparent on their labels. You know, another issue we haven't talked about is, you know, age requirements. Not just in terms of minimum age requirements, but age requirements, period. You know, you can't use an age statement for, you know, gin or something like that. Why not? If you want to be transparent.
You can't do barrel aging either.
Right, yeah. So you can do a lot of other things. In fact, a funny side story, we did some barrel aging of gins that our very first one at Revolution, we put in a French oak, a used French oak wine barrel, and TTB rejected the our initial label, which was aged in French oak or aged in a French oak barrel, but they accepted French oak barrel. Really?
The difference is. So just so I understand, I know with gin, you can't do barrel aging, but you can do an Old Tom style gin, which allows for barrel aging.
But you can do barrel aging. It's just a matter of how you describe it on the label.
Correct. Yeah. So, and that's the difference. And I don't think we have that convoluted aspect with bourbon.
Just like you had the Compass Box discussion a couple of weeks ago. Where
did you watch that one?
I did. And you know, that's a really great discussion point. If you want to be really transparent about what's in your bottle, why can't you say exactly what percentage of what thing is at what age? And I don't know why anybody would do this, but if you had a bottle of bourbon that was 90% 8 years old and 10% 6 months old, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Right?
That's what they did with the 3 years. They put 3 year whiskey on it, but really most of it was 20 plus years old.
Yeah.
I forget exactly.
But if you want to be transparent and honest, why not allow somebody to say exactly what's in the bottle?
I agree completely. And I think that's where the Scotch Malt Whiskey Association falls short. Their intention of the law and their wording of the law actually contradict each other. Mm-hmm. So I know we've got a few minutes. Do you mind if we run long for the podcast portion?
Sure.
Because I'm enjoying the discussion. So,
let's wrap it up.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll go ahead and just say, guys, if you want to listen to the rest of this, we're gonna put it up on iTunes. So the radio portion and the Facebook portion is going to be a flat hour. But we're going to continue this discussion on iTunes and Google Play. So if you guys want to follow us there, switch over. Cheers, guys. Thanks for coming, Mark.
Yeah, absolutely. Cheers.
Have you tried this yet?
I have tried. This is a barrel pick, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
So, Jack Daniel's rolled out a barrel program to kind of test the waters about doing barrel proof picks.
Mm-hmm.
For years, they've done the 90 proof or 95 proof. They've done the single barrel line. So slight bump in proof. This is a huge jump in proof. So I think they went from 90 proof. This is 40% more alcohol than – I'm sorry, 40 proof, so 20% more alcohol.
Which is still
considerable. It's still a considerable amount increase of their standard product. And I think this is where they shine the most because this is their raw product, unadulterated. This is what Jack Daniel's exudes. And so they
What's the age on it? Is it different from
So their standard process I believe is I think the minimum they blend is 4 years. And you know, there's no set. So they taste till it's ready. Sorry, hiccups. So if they have something that's not quite ready at 4 but is great at 6, then that's when they pick it. Mm-hmm. So this one's actually a little more than 6 years old, which is, I think, incredible.
Kind of perfect.
Perfect
age.
Yeah. And in the old days, and we talked about this with I'm trying to remember who was on the show before. Oh, with Bernie Lubbers. They were talking about in the old days, a lot of old-timers didn't trust anything older than 8 years old, mm-hmm. somewhere around there. And nowadays, we focus on age statements because I think of Scotch. Right.
Well, and it's completely wrong to do that.
Correct. Yeah.
And I think it's it makes it difficult for U.S. producers because people who don't get nerdy about the whole barrel maturation sort of process, they think, well, if you can age a Scotch for 25, 30, 40 years that and it's better, then a 25, 30, 40-year-old bourbon should be better also.
Oh, it's awful. I had a 30 – so Redemption did a barrel strength release of like a 36-year-old bourbon last year, and I drank it.
Yeah.
And so the difference between Scotch and bourbon, people say, well, why does it work for Scotch and why doesn't it work for bourbon? Well, the aging conditions are different. The barrel types are different. Well, what do you mean? I thought Scotch was aged in ex-bourbon barrels. Yeah, ex-bourbon barrels. A brand new fresh barrel mm-hmm. for 36 years is going to make a very, very intense product. And the nose on it, by the way, was exceptional.
I've had it. I liked it a lot.
I thought the nose was exceptional, but the product itself, tasting, was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It was an oak. It was an old boat.
Actually, I will say I had it at a tasting where there were a lot of different things going on, and it was later on. I'd like to have it on its own.
So if I had known that, I still have a sample bottle of it that's left. On its own, it was a part of what I love about this hobby is the experience, right? So trying something that's a piece of history.
Mm-hmm.
Like a 36-year-old bourbon, the world's oldest bourbon released or whatever. I'm all for it. The experience was incredible. The actual taste as like, is this a good bourbon? It was not. It was awful.
But, and you know, that kind of raises something that's interesting. You know, I follow HBS. I follow a bunch of different groups on the internet, different platforms and whatnot. And it's always fun to watch the discussion about where somebody will post about how much they like a certain thing. And then somebody else really hates it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it becomes
shits all over it.
Well, it becomes a debate about whether it's good or bad and not about the difference between people's palates. And
so,
it's a huge difference.
I agree, and I'll be honest with you. I think that happens specifically or primarily in bourbon as opposed to Scotch. I think when it comes – and I'm going to say some things I probably shouldn't.
No, that's good. I like that.
There are people in the group who have really great lane that mm-hmm. they're in, right? They have a great palate for that lane. They only drink bourbon, and their palate's attuned to, like, that classic Wild Turkey profile, or their classic mm-hmm. this profile, their classic that profile. that's their lane, and they don't branch out of it. And when you introduce something like Copper and Kings brandy that's in the next sherry barrel that's got some peated notes, some smoky notes to it, to them they think it's awful. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole group of folk who really, really enjoy it. And there becomes a real philosophical question as to whether something is good or bad. M.B. Rowland was one of those picks.
This is something I think about all the time. And I think that being so closely integrated with the business, you know, I taste a lot of stuff all the time. And I taste things from, you know, various places in production, various ages and things like that. And I think that it's really important when you're tasting to, if you care about this, to get to a place where you can taste something and recognize that it's well made, even if you don't like it, versus something that is just kind of shit.
So there are people, and I'm really not discrediting opinions here. So let me make sure.
You can't, because opinions are not discreditable. Everybody has opinions
are discreditable.
Fair enough.
But what I mean is, and I'm going to take a little stance here on the M.B. Rowland thing. I took some of the my palate is nothing. I like what I like. I'm not important in regards to my palate. But we took a couple of people that are very, very well respected up to M.B. Rowland, which is an old Amish dairy farm up in the southern Kentucky, and did a barrel pick. And these people who have always had universally high-praised opinions, palates, loved these two barrels. When those barrels got here, there were some people who couldn't stand it. Now, that doesn't mean it's a great product. It doesn't mean it's that I'm not disagreeing or agreeing. I'm just saying that there was a stark line in the sand for some people who thought hot dog water or wet dog when other people thought this is great, this is good. So it's, I'm not saying either one's right, and I'm definitely not saying either one's wrong, but it really does show a two sides of the coin, per se. And it happens all the time with brandy. I saw you wrote down
the word brandy. Because I wanted to mention one of the things I'm really excited about with HBS is I'm seeing posts about brandy all the time. I've always been a huge fan of brandy. I think it's the next big thing. And by next big thing, I think it's next sort of small big thing. It's going to take a lot of time to get there. But I'm really excited to see other people sort of embracing it and experiencing it.
I think that the thing that's riding the bourbon tails is rum, but I think just behind
that. I agree with that, too.
I think just behind that is brandy, and I agree with you completely. I think that one thing I love is, although we may all start off in a certain lane, a group that size and with enough people talking about something different, people are going to branch out. And we are seeing a significant branch out in the group of people trying stuff like Copper and Kings. The Houston Bourbon Consortium just bought a barrel of the Phoenix barrel of Copper and Kings brandy. We're doing two barrel picks of Armagnac. Travis, I think, was talking about buying a few barrels of Lincoln Tata Armagnac.
Right.
And then Greg Duxakis, who does a rum with Plantation and a brandy or a cognac. People are now saying, okay, people are learning what eau de vie is for the first time, right? So I think it's a very, very positive thing that people are being introduced to these spirits and branching out, and I'm excited.
I do, and to the credit of HBS, I think the number of people who are really getting into brandy and posting and sharing their experience, I think it opens up the door to other people who, you know, so many people, and I see this all the time, there are people who are vodka drinkers. Bless their hearts.
Yeah.
I have no bias. Vodka has a very important place in the cocktail scene.
We wouldn't be where we are with some things if it weren't for vodka.
Because vodka pays the bills.
Yeah.
Or it used to. I don't know if it does so much anymore. But
depends on if you're Tito's.
Right. So when people talk about – a few people talk about brandy in a way that gets other people interested, not necessarily excited yet, but they haven't gone there yet. They haven't had the incentive or somebody pushing them to try it. I think once you try good brandy, you're not going to turn back.
So I think I agree completely.
And I'll say that's not just grape brandy, but fruit brandies generally.
This show is called Whiskey Neat, but I've committed and said repeatedly that the show is specifically about barrel-aged spirits. And that includes beers that spend time in a barrel.
Well, you should include barrel-aged gins in that.
So, well, I haven't had them on yet. I've talked to them. We did the first Phoenix barrel for Texas. And there's been one after that, and there's been several people doing the Copper and Kings barrels. I want to get them on the show to talk about their barrel-aged gin. They do a Old Tom-style barrel-aged gin that's cask strength at $60. And it is. And now that we're on iTunes, I can say that. It's fucking phenomenal.
And it's the Copper and Kings stuff?
Copper and Kings.
I've not seen that.
Are you going down south today at all? NASA Liquor?
No, I think all of my stops are north.
So I think there's an account here in town that has it on the shelf. But if you go into Anvil, maybe, they have a barrel-aged Copper and Kings gin at cask strength that as a neat spirit, no water, no nothing, just straight for what it is mind-blowingly fascinating. I mean, all of those botanicals and that vegetal notes just really explode, and you're experiencing something that, if you're only a bourbon drinker, it will change your mind about branching out. It's $60, and they sell.
Well, I think it's important to branch out, to try things that you wouldn't normally. I always try to force myself to try things that I wouldn't normally drink.
I actually started with scotch. I've always been a big scotch proponent, and this episode's actually sponsored by our folks over at Glenmorangie. I've always said that craft beer does better here because we don't have those German purity laws. We get to experiment with whatever we want, and that's why we have such an explosive scene here. And I think you're seeing that with scotch, and I know that scotch has recently argued to try to get to age scotch in tequila barrels.
Right. And I'm not sure how I feel about that, but I also think it's not any of my business since I'm not Scottish.
Well, I agree. I'm not sure how I feel about it either. I like some mezcal, some smoky mezcals. I don't know how I feel about aged scotch in a tequila barrel, but
I love to taste mezcal. I don't necessarily love to drink it.
Oh, so I started on peated whiskeys. Let me find room here so I don't hit the mic. Peated whiskeys, mezcals like Del Maguey, were my introduction into the agave spirit world. Because before, my knowledge of tequila was...
I've never been, until fairly recently, interested at a deep level in agave spirits and Sotol, but I'm kind of coming around on that.
I saw an article about Sotol. I want to try it. I also saw on the website for the TDSA that you guys have is there a tequila producer here in Texas?
There's a Sotol producer here right outside of Austin, and it's a really, really interesting product. It's something that I was familiar with but didn't really know much about until these guys opened up. And, I went out and I met with them a couple of months ago. I love these guys. They're really, really doing a great job. A couple of interesting things. I thought when I first saw the articles, pictures of the building and whatnot, I thought, these guys spent millions of dollars on a Sotol-focused, Sotol-only distillery.
That's a passion, not a business decision.
Well, but I went out and met with them and talked to them, and it's very business decision-oriented. And I told Brent, I said, you are either fucking crazy and will be destitute in a year, or you are going to be the next Tito's of spirits. One or the other, because there's no market for Sotol.
Not yet.
For whether it's made here or made there.
So tell us, what is Sotol?
Sotol is very similar to an agave spirit. It's an entirely different plant, different species. It's actually part of the asparagus family. But it has a piña similar to agave. The production process is very similar. The end result, I've tasted several different ones, and I'm not really sure how to describe versus tequila or mezcal. I would say it's but it's certainly in that same family.
What's the general price range? Let me do this.
I've seen it all over the place.
If you had to recommend an introduction to Sotol for our listeners, and this is not on camera, by the way, right? This is just audio.
Oh, good. I can get comfortable.
You can relax. Yeah. So if you had to recommend a Sotol to try at a price point, what would you say?
The Desert Drawer Sotol is relatively expensive.
Desert
Drawer. That's the
drawer, guys, like
Desert Door.
Door. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, it's coffee.
Yeah. The high proof spirits will kind of numb your mouth.
The combination of all Desert Door. I think their retail price is around $60.
Okay.
So it's fairly pricey.
Is it barrel aged? What's the...
They do have a barrel aged version. I'm not sure if it's available outside of the distillery. They've got very, very small quantities of it.
What kind of proof are we talking?
I think the barrel aged, I tasted some yesterday that was cask strength. I think it was about 120, but I think they're bottling it at about 100.
That's great.
But it's very limited. And I thought the barreled stuff was, I liked the regular stuff. The barreled stuff I thought was just.
The specs have it on the tequila aisle, I guess?
I know it's available here. I'm not sure where. I would probably check Total first.
I'm gonna go immediately after we meet today and buy a bottle.
It's a blue ceramic bottle. It's a really interesting standout sort of bottle.
Okay.
And they tried to be very true to kind of what you – the authenticity was important to them. There's an interesting sort of debate about using the term Sotol in the United States that it's protected in Mexico sort of the way tequila is.
Yeah. I think is Starka, which there was some debate over.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Starka is, an Eastern European beverage that has some protection. I think there was some debate over whether or not they could be called that. Yeah. So
what's interesting about Sotol is that's the name of the plant. So you don't typically protect the name of a plant. You protect a region or some other sort of tequila thing.
Yeah.
Right. My understanding is there are some producers in Mexico that really appreciate what they're doing and are supportive because it helps make the market for them up here, and then others that feel like there's some appropriation going on.
Yeah.
I feel like I've heard more – I do too, and that's an entirely
– entirely different discussion.
That's a whole podcast.
That's about six more drinks in.
Exactly. But, it's a really interesting thing. There's a history of it in Texas, New Mexico, Arizona. And it's an area that people haven't really explored yet. So I think it's kind of exciting and interesting. I think you had Morgan on.
Morgan
recently.
Weber.
I think he's kind of playing in that space, right?
So I've enjoyed every episode. Part of what I love about this is just sitting down with people over great conversation. Mm-hmm. And I've seen you interact online and we've talked a few times. But the episode I had with Morgan was one of the early ones that I was like, this was awesome, right? Mm-hmm. So I think – there aren't many conversations about behind the scenes. It's the way the three-tier system works and the way that – well, it doesn't matter. We're not on the camera anymore. The way the three-tier system works and the way that restaurants and allocations and priorities, you know. So that was the first conversation we had in which people got to see a little bit more about how those things work.
Mm-hmm.
To the average consumer, which we know, right?
Right.
So I've been doing this been working tangentially to the industry for the past 4 years. You've been doing it almost at least a decade, right?
About, yeah.
But the average Joe doesn't quite understand, not average Joe in an insulting way for those getting their feelings hurt, but the average person doesn't understand how those priorities in the industry work. And it's always, in Texas, it's always been on-premise.
Right.
Because they felt like that's the best way to market your brand. This bottle of Jack gets tasted by 20 people as opposed to one guy hoarding, and then it does nothing for their brand. So I'm rambling a bit, but yeah. So I'll try it out. You can blame Rosewater specifically down the. Have you ever been down there?
Rosewater? I haven't. No.
Have you know Pasha?
Only via the internet. You know, we've had a couple of exchanges.
So Pasha, who was on the very first episode here, it's one of the best craft cocktail bars in Houston. He's in Nico's book, Texas Cocktails, and he has like the safe haven for exploration where his back bar is sectioned into some of the best introductions to new spirits. So if you ever want to try something, you can branch out into tequilas here, mezcals there, rums, you know. Huge fan of Rosewater, but that's where I got introduced to Del Maguey.
Okay.
So I love the smoky mezcal, which reminds me of the peated scotch, and, you know, it just kind of goes from there. But Armagnac, brandy, it's all branching out. I think we'll be doing quite a bit of non-whiskey-related spirits over the past. HBS is at least. So we bought a rum barrel. We're doing two Armagnac barrels. And, I mean, I'm open to anything. You know, we've got the size.
I think it's great. You try it all. You know, I mean, there are things that I don't particularly care for, but I still try them because I want to know what they are, where they come from, what they're like, how they compare to other things, you know.
This is the last spirit I wanted you to try. So I'm actually really excited about this. I know you said you started in Scotch, as did I. This is a signatory vintage cask that really the only place to get those single casks are in Specs in Texas. But they did a 20-year-old – oh, sorry, Siri. Let's turn that off. They did a 20-year-old sherry cask at Specs, 51.3 cask strength, $100. So nowadays, $100 in bourbon will get you a 14-year-old whiskey. 15-year-old whiskey. This is a 20-year-old Scotch, which historically used to be more expensive, but I'm a huge fan of this.
Is this something widely available?
No, no.
You got to know somebody named Hart to get it.
No. You can get it at Specs in Texas. It is 20 years old, and they're the only ones in Texas to carry it. It's a Specs product. But it's basically a barrel pick of their single malt. It produced 539 bottles, so there's a plenty to go around. But they're $100, and they're not sponsored. I just am a huge fan of this particular single malt. I mean, it's all those sherry notes, that those Christmas flavors, raisins, you know, baked fruits. And I knew we were doing craft bourbon. I thought I'd bring a Scotch just for fun.
That's really nice. Yeah.
So we've got a few minutes left. I wanted to ask you, what do you feel is the biggest issue in the Texas craft world right now? What's the biggest thing you want to fight? Whether it be TTB, TABC, or behavior with transparency.
I think the challenge right now, like as of today, and this, you know, every day is a little bit different, but you know, I think you commented on or shared the post recently about that bottle that I saw. This is Texas whiskey. Which is not Texas and it's not whiskey.
Oh, yes, the one at Total Wine.
Right.
The one I thought was a travesty, yes.
Yeah, and so this is the problem. Aside from the whole labeling and transparency issue, that day I had been talking with a friend of mine who's a distributor, just generally catching up, and he mentioned, you know, the number of requests he gets every day from producers, Texas or otherwise, wanting him to consider and pick up products. It's happened with distributors all over the country. Everybody is inundated. There's so many products, and some of them are really great. The biggest problem I see right now, and it doesn't matter if it's small craft or big legacy producers, is there's so much stuff available.
Sure.
And a lot of it is not necessarily very good. It's not necessarily
there's nothing special about it.
Right. But also things that are, you know, like that are not honest. The problem is they're taking up shelf space that could be available for really cool, unique, good, well-made products.
That would help everybody.
Right, that would help everybody.
And for those who don't know, there was a post that he had, or a picture he had taken at Total Wine of a bottle that said, what?
The I guess it's the brand name on it is, this is, in small letters, Texas Whiskey or something like that. And it's I think it says it's a blended whiskey, but in looking at it and thinking about it, I think it's probably a spirit whiskey.
Sure.
It's hard to tell. There's no age statement.
Spirit whiskeys can allow for a certain percentage of vodka, essentially added to the product. So
yeah, I feel like it said it was 30%
neutral grain
neutral
spirits.
But then on the front it said it was a blended whiskey or something. So there was that. There was no age statement. It's clear that it's pretty clear that it's sourced. You know, you can't always be for certain.
Right.
And I'm thinking, you know, maybe there's a place in the market for something like this, but let's be honest about what it is. And let's also not take up 3 feet of shelf space that could
for a money grab.
Right, for a money grab, and for, you know, you get several different sizes there. And I don't know anybody that's buying it. Apparently somebody is. That kind of gets into the issue of store and private labels, which is a whole other hour worth of discussion.
So I'll tell you, in my opinion, so I've been lucky enough. I've said before, my palate is shit. There's nothing special about my
mine's palate. The same. I probably shouldn't be in this business.
Right. So, however, my wife, I think, and this is not to pump her up. I think she has an exceptional nose. I had a broken nose years ago that I think has definitely affected my sense of smell, but she has consistently picked things that I like blind mm-hmm. that was accurate. Like she hit it on the, you know, my wife's got a great palate, but we've been blessed enough that a few distributors have sent me some potential products that they, mm-hmm. you know, samples that they receive. And we've tasted through a few things and just gave the feedback to the distributor saying, don't carry this. Mm-hmm. There's some things that might get picked up once as a novelty, you know, whiskey mm-hmm. in a ceramic bottle. But when they do get it, they're going to mix it off. They're mm-hmm. not going to buy it regularly. It's not going to be something that moves. And I encourage more of that, not from me, but you've got a group like HBS. You've got all these Facebook groups, and it's the only place that you're all allowed to legally talk,
mm-hmm.
right? So this three-tier system keeps everyone so separated. But you're allowed to give feedback and communicate with your consumer source, mm-hmm. and not just any consumer source. You're talking about people that regularly have the liquid income to stockpile mm-hmm. 500 bottles, right? So there's tons
yeah, but
of,
I don't want people stockpiling bottles. I want people drinking
well,
through.
Well, when I say
right?
stockpiling, I mean drinking not as fast mm-hmm. as they can gather, right? So you
sure, buy that stuff and put it back, but keep going through and trying new things.
Correct.
Be experimental. You know, HBS, there's so much legacy stuff, and there's nothing wrong with that because it's really good, but I wish I saw more people experimenting and trying out some of the other, whether it's Texas or whether it's another
branching
state.
Out, yeah. right? But that's where that
stuff.
When you've got the single largest market group, the largest single market group in the nation, right? That HBS really is, good or bad, it's the largest single mm-hmm. market group in the nation. You're going to have those who are new to the hobby. You're going to have those who stay in their lane. Mm-hmm. But you're also going to have a certain section that branch out. And I would encourage, if viable, there's got to be a way to do it. Because we do it. We send samples out to each mm-hmm. other. We'll buy a bottle of something, and none of us are sure about it. So we'll break it down mm-hmm. into 25-ounce samples.
Right.
Send it out to the group. And then we all give our feedback on it. As a distributor, if you're sent something, send it out to the group, and you've got
a
mix bag.
Idea.
You can send it to the yeah. you can send it to the fresh folks. You can mm-hmm. send it to the people who stay in the lane, mm-hmm. and you can send it to the experts.
Right.
Or I say experts. What's the better word? The
nerds.
Well, the nerds. yeah. Whatever. Sure. So you send it to your market audience and get a consensus on something, mm-hmm. as opposed to. And I'll put them out there. Favorite brands, I know for a fact, the guy that decides for Texas what to carry as in their distribution has his desk is covered in bottles.
Right.
But and you can't get to them fast enough.
Everybody, every distributor
Texas
is covered
way.
In bottles.
Yeah.
And it's a challenge because I know that they want to carry really good stuff that's going to move. I know that they want to pick up products that have support from their producers, suppliers, distillers.
Sure.
I think that one of the challenges in the production part of the industry is you got a lot of new entrants who don't understand that once you make something and put it in a bottle and a shipping case, that's not the end of your job. You got to go out and market it and sell
and
it.
Move and move it.
Yeah, that's not the distributor's job.
So I've said in the past that the focus has always been on premise. When a new release comes out, they will do brand education, mm-hmm. right, for those who don't know.
Right.
They'll go to a restaurant and they'll host an event at USBG where they invite bartenders from all over mm-hmm. Houston to educate them on the product to be able to move the product. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest with you, I think that depending on the bar, a certain percentage doesn't give a shit.
No,
about
you're
your
absolutely
brand.
Right.
So you're spending all this money trying to promote to them when I think you should be promoting to groups like Bourbon Hounds of Houston or Houston Bourbon Society, these groups where there's literally hundreds of people to learn right. about your product. And that, if we could focus that with distributors, then what you have is an enrichment of the category overall, right? Mm-hmm. Weed out the shit, the stuff where they're cutting corners and they're only trying to mass produce to the average consumer. They're the and I'm gonna shit on Tito's a little bit. They're the Tito's of the whiskey world. Mm-hmm. Tito's is legendary.
But, you know, to be fair, they fill a niche, an important
sure.
niche. You know, that's great. But there's so many other things out there that that we should spend some time and effort
and
on.
Learn about. Yeah,
yeah.
I agree completely. So. And I think we could, if more brands found ways to funnel feedback directly from consumers, I think it would help everybody involved.
I think that's a fantastic idea. Part of the challenge that we have, we meaning everybody in from production to end consumer, is that there's a model that was set up decades ago that has not changed to keep up with how the market works today.
It happens with regulations all the time. Yeah.
It's regulation. It's the way that people talk about and experience things. You know, total like going down a rabbit hole sort of thing. The Texas wine industry, 20, 30 years ago, those folks were growing grapes, Cabernet and Chardonnay grapes that didn't necessarily grow well and make good wine in Texas because that's what the market demanded. But now, fast forward, it's a much smaller world. People are open to new varietals and new things like that. So somebody can afford to plant a grape that grows well in this area and make a wine out of it, you know, Tempranillo or Viognier or something like that, that people are going to actually give it a shot and they're going to try it. In the 70s, nobody's going to buy a Texas anything that's not Cabernet because Cabernet is the thing that everybody drinks, right? Same thing with spirits and beer. Like the world's become a smaller place. It's easier for people to experiment. Let's make the market. Let's make the regulations, the tiers. Let's open it up a little bit.
Rethink things.
So that we can all be part of 2018 and not part of 1971.
I could not agree with you more. There is a severe short-sightedness that happens in the alcohol realm, even within Texas. There's a debate going on whether or not we should repeal alcohol, you know, bars being open on Sunday, mm-hmm. or what is it? Not bars, but alcohol being sold on Sundays. That people wonder if it would be counterintuitive to even staff an extra mm-hmm. day. And I disagree. I think that
if you don't want to be open on Sunday, don't be open on Sunday. But if somebody else wants to,
sure,
let them do
agreed.
It. You know, if we're going to be this sort of capitalist free market society that we always talk about, then let's do it. If it doesn't work, the market will take care of it.
I think we should be revisiting these discussions and just kind of buck those trends. It's, you know, like I said, when Travis and them and Yellow Rose tried to open a distiller here, no one knew how to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, they got kind of forced into revisiting it with a fresh set of eyes, but there's still room to grow in that realm. I think the category as a whole, even like stuff like Not Your Father's Bourbon, which is literally like it's definitely not your
father's bourbon.
It's also not bourbon. Like pardon my language. It's so fucking creative,
right?
Because it's literally telling you it's not bourbon because it's not bourbon,
right?
So Not Your Father's Beer. It's still beer, but Not Your Father's Bourbon mm-hmm. is both satisfying the requirements from the TCB while also, it's
yeah, you got to give them credit for being creative, but 100%. At the same time, it's total bullshit.
Total bullshit. Yeah. It's completely flavored whiskey, right. And they also insult their money, right? Mm-hmm. So when you produce a product, you can appeal. You could focus on just the product and hope to not offend anyone. Or you can mm-hmm. double down and focus on one or the other.
Right.
And they specifically in their advertisements say, who likes to drink bourbon by itself?
Who doesn't?
Like a ton of folks, right?
Yeah.
So they openly admit they add flavorings to it and this mm-hmm. and this and that. But they straight up insult those who just enjoy it neat. You know, everything we drank here today, six bottles worth, was just neat, you know?
You make that sound so...
And we were doing like less than, you know, quarter ounce pours or whatever.
Until the last couple,
you know. I got a call here. Let me just end that. So what did you think of the Jack Daniels? Are you a fan of the barrel proof?
I like it, yeah.
I mean, if you don't like it, it's fine. You're
I do like it. But then I'm probably not the right. I like a lot of things in a lot of different, you know, there are some people, as you said earlier, that are in a certain lane. They like things in this thing.
Correct.
I'm much more broad. Like correct. On any given day, I could go a different direction. So I liked it. Would I buy a bottle? Maybe not. Yeah. But I would definitely drink it. I'd definitely like maybe have a pour in a bar
pour
or something.
I'm always for trying something new. Mm-hmm. If you don't like it, you don't like it. But branching outside your comfort zone is the only way that you plan to grow.
No, you have to do that.
And people like Morgan and Pasha are the only reason. They're who I want to be when I grow up, right? Their palates are so adventurous that I admire it so deeply mm-hmm. that I'm willing to drink and try anything, you know? So Well, I know we've got hour and a half, so that was
that's a lot of stuff.
I appreciate it.
No,
actually,
it was fun.
I really, and this is the most fun of my day. Yeah, just sitting down and just talking about a little bit of everything.
There's just so much to talk about. I mean, it never stops.
It never stops.
Yeah, and you know, I love this business. I love booze. You know, I mean, I could talk about this forever.
I could talk about it.
You will have to stop.
If we had cigars here, we'd be here for another 4 hours. So.
Yeah.
I admire Joe Rogan's podcast where he can do 3-hour podcasts and it takes me 4 days to get through it.
Right.
So I try to be that conversation that's just honest and straightforward. Yeah. So,
well, I hope that was it or some portion of it.
Oh, sure it was. In fact, I'm going to push this really hard because I think there was a lot of information that a lot of people were not aware of that I think they're going to get from this conversation.
And I feel like we just hit the tip of the iceberg on it.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like we could make this a series and it would take forever before we really got through the whole.
Well, next time you're back in town, I don't know when, but next time you're back, come on the show.
It happens from time to time, you know, so I would love to do it.
You didn't come down here for this, right?
No. I had a I try to, anytime I travel,
if I can, kind of
package several things together.
Get it all knocked out at once.
But I got to admit, having done it now, it was enough fun that I would probably make the trip just to do it again.
Yeah, so we were lucky enough to have a few people fly in just for this, and this is, it's very complimentary, and I don't expect I don't expect the compliments, but it means something that we talked for an hour and 40 minutes nonstop, and it wasn't forced. Like it was just, I'm very passionate about the category altogether. So I just,
yeah, and honestly, I've got like 14 other topics that I'm like, I would love to talk about if we had time. So.
Well, next time you're down, or if you want to make the trip specifically for, I know that Balcones actually wanted to, Winston wants to come back on the show, and he specifically mentioned flying in just to talk with you. So
really?
Correct.
I love Winston. We can talk about cats and scents. And
we can talk about anything.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff.
So just the idea of Winston flying in just to have this discussion would be the world to me. So
that would be fun. Actually, I don't know if we could do it in an hour, but if we got several people.
Like, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of fun stuff.
Thanks so much.
So, yeah,
I appreciate
absolutely.
It. All right, guys. Cheers. Last one.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.